Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. My guest this week is Lama Mike Crowley, who is a longtime guest and contributor here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. He's one of the most interviewed and featured people that I've had over the span of the 15 plus years that I've been doing this podcast, and was very excited to welcome him back to talk about his new book, which is called Psychedelic Buddhism, A User's Guide to Traditions, Symbols, and Ceremonies. We'll be getting to that shortly, but first, of course, there are a few announcements that I need to make. First off, thanks to Brooke, who I mention pretty much every month at some point, who has a regular contribution that she makes via PayPal in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. Thank you very much, Brooke. Your long time and ongoing support is very much appreciated. This, of course, is a listener-supported podcast. There are no funding organizations, there are no commercial supporters, there's nothing like that. There's just you, the listener. So if you like this podcast, if you like the information that I put out and share on here and all the original music that I share and sharing from my audiobooks and all the rest of that, then I invite you to become a contributor. It's quite easy. You can go to my personal webpage at martinball.net, and there's a PayPal link at the top right of the page of my webpage. And also you can sign up as a patron over at Patreon. And there is also a link at the top right of my personal webpage over to my Patreon page, patreon.com/martinwball. And you get all kinds of increasing benefits and gifts and access as you move up the tiers through all of that. And of course, as I do mention, that there's only limited space here at my podcast host. I've been doing this a long, long time. So every time I post a new episode, I have to delete an old episode, and I generally go in order. And once it disappears from the main podcast, it goes over to my Patreon page and is available to my top four tiers of Patreon supporters. So starting at $20 a month, it gets you access to the entire back catalog, the archive of the Entheogenic Evolution. That is everything that I have that I can share over there. I think there's almost maybe around 100 episodes over there right now. So there's a lot over there. You get access to that. And you can also, at the top two tiers, you can get a 30 or 60 minute video call with me monthly to just shoot the shit, shoot the breeze, philosophize a bit, or do some integration and do some reflection. Always available for that. And of course, I'm also available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations. You can stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com if you want more info about my services there. Let's see. Other announcements to make. Coming up next weekend, even. My goodness, it's going to be next weekend. There is an event that's being put on by the Entheogenic Society of Washington, and it is a 24-hour event with one different host for each hour of the event starting at 10 a.m. on Saturday, June 10th. And the topic for this particular iteration of this event is entheogens and the environment. And I was invited to host one of those hours, so I'm going to be doing the 9 p.m. hour Pacific time on Saturday, June 10th. You can find out more at entheosocietywa.org. You can get tickets and you can get access to the full 24 hours, and you can see the lineup of other speakers that they have there. And I'm going to be focusing on the idea of psychedelics and environmental inspirationalism. If you have any familiarity at all with my art, with my novels, with my music, with my photography, you know I'm big into nature and the environment, but I don't press it as an environmental activist. What I like to do is actually help inspire people by using nature in my work. You can see it in my photography, you can see it in my art, you can hear it in my music where I go out and I make field recordings, like my song Whale Song, for example. I recorded whales in Maui by taking a recorder underwater, and then I used all of that in creating a song. And that's what I like to do, is to use this information, use this input, and then kind of co-create with it. And speaking of all that, if you've read any of my novels, you know that the environment is a major theme, and I'm happy to announce that my second novel, which is now my 12th audiobook, The Fate of Mirani, is now officially available at Audible and should be up at Amazon and the iBookstore. And really happy that that project is all complete and is now available. And of course, as I mentioned, I have been sharing the music from the soundtrack that I created for the audiobook. And I still have a couple more songs to share there. So I've been sharing it at my Facebook and Instagram pages as a reel and as a story and also as a post of the individual tracks. And you can find that and all of my music over at martinball.bandcamp.com. Also, just want to remind everyone that coming up July 21st through 23rd, there is the Sanctum Psychedelic Conference happening in Portland, Oregon. You can get more information about that at sanctum.org, and that is Sanctum spelled with a P, P-S-A-N-C-T-U-M, sanctum.org. And if you want more information about that, check out the interview that I did with Tom Hatzis just the other week that is available here on the podcast. And that's about it in terms of announcements to bring to all of you. I do want to say with this interview with Mike Crowley, I did have a lot of internet connection issues during the interview. We got cut off several times. It's actually been an ongoing problem with my internet provider, and I've now switched. And since switching, everything's been great. Have not lost internet even once. So really glad I made that switch. But there are some glitches here in the interview with Mike, and I have to kind of stitch it together here on the podcast. So I apologize for that, but it was great to have Mike on. And as we discussed during the interview, that really we kind of need to do a follow-up because we didn't actually talk about a whole lot of the things that are in the book, and I want to do that, but Mike always has a lot to share, and he's just an encyclopedia of information about Buddhism and Hinduism and Eastern religious traditions. I mean, he is a lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, so he's well-educated about all of this. So we had a great conversation, and I'm going to share that with you now. Hope you enjoy, and be back next week with the next selection from my medical memoir, A Sleep Story. So we'll kind of get back into the grime of all of that. And then lots more interviews to come. So lots to share with you here on the podcast and in the coming weeks and months. All right. Here's my conversation with Lama Mike Crowley about his book, Psychedelic Buddhism, A User's Guide to Tradition, Symbols, and Ceremonies. And the book is available now. You can go find it anywhere you find books. All right. About your book, Psychedelic Buddhism. So,
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Lama Mike Crowley back on the podcast again to talk about Buddhism and psychedelics. And just maybe let's just start for anybody who says, what, psychedelic Buddhism? Did Mike already write that book? I'd invite you to make the clear distinction between what is the difference from the previous book to this new book that has just been released.
Well, it's quite easy to state. The first book, which by anyone hasn't read it, it's called Secret Drugs of Buddhism, and it's still available in bookstores right now. That was an account of the history of psychedelics within Buddhism, the history of their use, that is. And I begin with the use of Soma in Vedic Hinduism. We don't absolutely know what Soma was, but there are some pretty good guesses. And the guesses basically are mushrooms. And the quibbles come down to which kind of mushrooms. It's mostly Psilocybe cubensis and Amanita muscaria. First of all, it was Amanita. The Vedic Hindus migrated into India about 2500 BC and brought Soma with them. All we know about Soma is literally it means juice. So they consumed juice as part of their religion. Their religion, by the way, was practiced only by one caste, the Brahmin caste. If you wanted religion done, you paid the Brahmins to do it for you.
Right.
People didn't generally have a religion. Now, when they encountered the Indian civilizations of Northwest India, they found that the locals had their own mushroom, which they were using, and they gleefully accepted this as another form of soma. So we imagine the indigenous entheogen was Psilocybe cubensis. Okay, so that was that book. And I went into the use of entheogens by Buddhism. And Buddhism lasted in India until about 1400, when it was eradicated by the invading Muslims. And around 1000 AD, they had expanded the use of what they called Amrita, which just means deathlessness. They were very big on vague titles for their entheogens. They didn't like spell it out and say it's this species, whatever. We wouldn't understand anyway. But Buddhism adopted the soma of the Vedas, but used a different word, Amrita. And then by the time of the first millennium, by the time of 1000 AD, they had increased the scope of Amrita to include various other things like acacia, and the certain acacias contain DMT, and so forth. I go into this in great detail in Secret Drugs of Buddhism, if anybody is at all interested. Now, when I wrote that book, I had a lot of people saying, yes, that's all very well for history, but how do we practice using psychedelics today? Well, that's what this book is about. It offers psychedelics for Buddhism and Buddhism for psychedelicists. So there are a number of aspects to the book. I give tips on how to use psychedelics as part of Buddhism, and I have an extensive survey of psychedelics which may be used in Buddhism and why. Well, that seems to be about a decent pocket explanation of the book. So what else do you want to know?
Yeah. I think that's a good distinguishing between the two books. With Secret Drugs of Buddhism, it's kind of more a scholarly analysis, historical analysis. This new book, The Psychedelic Buddhism, A User's Guide, I like the subtitle, A User's Guide to Traditions, Symbols, and Ceremonies. It's much more of this sort of hands-on approach of, okay, we've looked at the historical aspects of it, but what about if people... Either Buddhists who want to apply psychedelics within their Buddhist practice, or if you're into psychedelics and you'd like to start practicing Buddhism, it's very practical in that sense. And also, just for listeners, I would remind them that if they haven't heard it, the last interview that I did with you, I just checked my podcast. It was posted November 30th, 2020. And that, what was the title to that one? Let me call it up again. It is Mike Crowley, Lama on the Down Low. So that you are a scholar of Buddhism. You are also a practicing Buddhist, and you are a practicing psychedelic enthusiast. So you kind of know this from all different sides, that you've got your bases covered, that if we're going to talk to anyone about psychedelics and Buddhism, Mike Crowley is the man. So anybody who's listening who hasn't heard that interview, you've got to scroll way down in the podcast feed, and then you can find that interview with Mike from November 30th, 2020. And that's, again, this Mike Crowley, Llama on the Down Low. And so I used that you had sent me a preview copy of the book, and I used that for my little blurb that I created for you, saying that Llama Mike Crowley comes fully out of the psychedelic Buddhist closet with psychedelic Buddhism. Because in that previous interview, we had talked about how you had maybe clandestine or you hadn't really put it out in the open about the use of psychedelics within the context of Buddhism as a Llama. But anyway, people can go and listen to that. So yeah, there's a number of things that I'd love to talk to you about that are present in the book here. But maybe let's just start that it's broken down very nicely. Oh, and actually, before I even do that, I'll just share with you that, you're a friend and a colleague, and you sent me a preview copy of the book, and I read it, so that allowed you. This is the pile of books from authors who want to be interviewed on the podcast, but you got to skip the line, and people can tell by my voice that it's a heavy pile. So I've got a lot of books here, so I haven't read most of them, but I really enjoyed reading psychedelic Buddhism, and it came from you, so of course I was going to read it right away. But it's broken down into three parts. So we've got a little bit of an introduction, and maybe you want to recount the story of your granddaughter, but we have part one, psychedelics for Buddhists, and we have part two, Buddhism for psychonauts, and part three, becoming a psychedelic Buddhist, and then the appendices are resources for the reader. So again, it's very hands-on, it's very practical. It's about how do we apply this? This is not a theoretical work. This is a practical work. I'd invite you to start with the encounter with your granddaughter, you start the book off with that.
I received an email from my granddaughter when she was seven, and it said basically, "Dear Granddad, could you tell me about the drugs which make you see things?" And I was completely banjaxed by this. I called up a mother and said, "What is Eleanor asking me about this? I don't understand." And she said, "Oh, well, we had this conversation about ghosts. And we said, you know, there are lots of things which would cause you to see things which aren't actually there. You could be deranged by the death of a loved one, and you might think that you see the loved one sitting in their normal chair or whatever. And it could be this, it could be that. And basically what your mum was telling you about, that there is there are substances which can help you see things which aren't there. They're not really there, but there are different substances." And I explained to her that some of these substances can really make you think that there are entities in your presence who are communicating with you. Like, I've actually spoken to a guy who spent hours talking to his friend's dog. And he was convinced when he came out of it, he was on one of these pseudo psychedelics. It was Deadly Nightshade, I think, that he was on. But there are various substances like the Solanum dulcimara, the deadly nightshade plant, which produce true hallucinations. I don't mean hallucinations which are true, but they are truly hallucinations. LSD doesn't give you true hallucinations. you might see a coil of rope and think it's a snake for a second or two, maybe. But the next second, you think it looks like a miniature castle or a crouching creature. You know, these things run through your mind, and you can actually play with it while on psychedelics and say, I'll see if I can make it look like a dragon. And, you know, within seconds, it looks like a dragon.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be frightened of that dragon because you don't think it is a dragon. You know, it's just a coil of rope, which looks like a dragon. Now, I explained all this to my granddaughter in the letter, and I was fortunate not to receive any further communication. So I assume that she took it all on board. In fact, her father contacted me a little while later and said that he'd been mowing the lawn when suddenly Eleanor said, "No, Daddy, stop, stop, there's a mushroom. It might be one of those magic ones that Granddad told me about." So it wasn't, but he mowed around it all the same.
Oh, very, very nice. Cute. So, yeah, this is kind of an interesting entryway into talking about Buddhism and psychedelics, because a big part of Buddhism, particularly the form of Buddhism that you are most closely associated with, which would be the Vajrayana school, there's a lot of seeing as, in the sense of seeing the deities of emanations of yourself, kind of going back to like seeing a rope, and you can see it as a snake, you can see it as a dragon, and which is very different than the nightshade family hallucinations, where people do report having conversations with somebody who is not there, and they usually don't report other psychedelic effects at that time. I was like, well, I had this whole conversation, but there was actually nobody there the whole time. But more of what we're experiencing.
I actually had a neighbor who did nightshade, and he did it on a Saturday. No effects on the Sunday. He thought he was ready to go to work on Monday morning. He was a carpenter, and he's driving to work, and somebody else was driving. He was the passenger, and he began to see all these gnomes on the, just like doing their gnomish things on the side of the road. And he was like, "Oh, I don't think it's worn off yet." I had to tell the guy, "Look, I'm feeling really sick. Could you take me back home?" So, yeah, they can be not only dangerous in that they fool your senses into thinking there's something really there, but it persists a lot longer than you imagine it's going to.
Yeah, yeah. So one of these fundamental questions in Buddhism is, how are we seeing things? And the tendency to objectify things, including the self, to say, well, I am me, and this is that, and that is this, and mm-hmm. I'm wanting to categorize everything. But of course, at the heart, again, within like Vajrayana Buddhism, is the notion of the Dharmakaya, that the ultimate emptiness of all things within the truth body, that there are no separate objects, really. We, at the conventional level, we see them that way, we interact with them that way, but the difference between how things appear and how they really are, that's kind of one of the fundamental questions of Buddhism. Would you agree with that or amend that?
I would. But I would add the caveat that we cannot express how things really are.
Yeah.
We can appreciate it. We can see how things really are, but putting it into words is another matter. And as soon as you enter the realm of words, you have left the realm of the Dharmakaya.
Right.
As Buddhists, we're very skeptical about jumping to conclusions. That we did to say, "Oh yes, that dog is talking to me," would be anathema to a Buddhist. You might say, "It seems as if that dog is talking to me," but you wouldn't make a definitive statement about it.
Right. So when it comes to the contemporary practice of Buddhism, particularly here in the West, maybe we can kind of start with that and then how people might be applying psychedelics within it. But traditionally, and throughout most of Asia, Buddhism always distinguished, or maybe not, I mean, you know more about this than I do, but the idea that there are basically two categories. There's the monastic category of those are the quote unquote, the real Buddhists who are dedicated. And then there's the lay persons who are in support of the monastics. So a lot of Buddhism operated through these monastic institutions and that you take your vows, you become a monk, you become a nun, and then you're really dedicating pretty much every day and every moment to the process of seeking enlightenment and the absorption of Buddhist teachings. And then the lay people support that. But here in the West, things are a little bit different. People might go to a Zendo and, you know, practice some Zazen, or they might take up vegetarianism, or they might take up loving kindness meditations and call themselves a Buddhist. So when we're talking about applying psychedelics to Buddhism, how do you see that as happening in the West, and what kind of context? I'm just curious.
Well, yeah, you touched upon a difficult subject. There are Westerners who consider that Buddhism doesn't allow the use of psychedelics, doesn't allow any kind of mind-altering drugs at all. And this is, in fact, a Western invention. There is, not necessarily Western, because Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, told his students that they should refrain from all psychedelic drugs, all drugs. And this is a modern innovation. Basically, there are five vows which are taken, possibly taken, don't have to be, it's not a requirement of Buddhism, but they could be taken by laymen. These are: not to kill, not to lie, not to steal, not to commit sexual improprieties, and not to take alcohol. Alcohol. That's what it says. Don't drink alcohol. And it says nothing about other drugs. But modern Westerners have seized upon this pledge not to drink alcohol and expanded it to mean not to take any mind-altering substances. In earlier times, this was not the case. In Vajrayana, that is the Vajrayana path, there was first of all, Hinayana, the lesser vehicle. This is what it means, Hina, lesser, Yana, vehicle. This is not what they call themselves, of course. They just call themselves Buddhists. Yeah. But the Mahayana, the great vehicle, which expanded Buddhism to include lay people as well as monks and nuns, said, well, there's our Mahayana, the great vehicle, like a huge train that you can buy a ticket to board, as opposed to the horse which you had to ride on your own. So they said there was a Hinayana, and now we've got this great Mahayana. Later in the Mahayana scheme, there was the Vajrayana, the thunderbolt vehicle. And this is only one name. It's not the only name which was given to this path. And it was sometimes called the Sahajayana, the natural vehicle, or the Guhyayana, the secret vehicle. And in order to embark on this vehicle, which is actually part of Mahayana, shares most of its philosophy with the Mahayana just goes a little bit further into saying that, you know, psychedelics are good for you. And in order to embark on the Vajrayana path, you have to perform certain practices 100,000 times. There's four practices. Going for refuge and 100,000 times. Then there's the mandala offering, where you imagine the whole universe as a mandala, and you create this mandala out of piles of rice on a metal plate, and then wipe it off and start again. You do that 100,000 times with the appropriate recitations, of course. And then there's the Vajrasattva practice, which you recite the 100-syllable mantra of Vajrasattva 100,000 times. And there's the Guru Yoga practice, which you there is a particular visualization which you have to perform. It's in our school, it's Vajrayogini, a Dakini, and you visualize yourself as this Dakini 100,000 times. Traditionally, you would do these 400,000 practices, and you'd go to your teacher and you say, "Well, I've finished all that. I've done all the 100,000." And the teacher will say, wait, you did how many? 100,000? No. You know those three beads on the end of the mala? You've got to count those too. It's not just 108 times for each repetition. You've got to do 111. So you've then got to go back and do your extra practices for each of these. Nowadays, they let you know up front and don't put any games on you. But once you've done this, you're eligible for Vajrayana teachings. And in order to set forth on the Vajrayana path, you have to have an initiation, at least one initiation into Vajrayana practice. A little difficulty arises here, though. I've read hundreds of books on Buddhism and on Vajrayana and so on. Only one of them, a translation of a 10th century Tibetan work, says that there are seven levels of secrecy in Vajrayana. If you get an initiation, you probably expect that you're going to get the whole thing revealed to you. No, that's just the first level. You've got to be really dedicated in order to get all seven levels revealed to you. And I mean, I'm a lama and I haven't completed all these seven levels. Everything which I've put in the books, I have worked out myself. These are not being revealed to me by my teachers. The most I got from my teacher actually was one interview I had with him, and he said to me, "Oh, people tell me that you take psychedelics. Is this true?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Good." And moved on to some other subject. It was only one word of approval from him. And there are tales from Tibet of ascended masters who have revealed all these secrets to average people in the street. There was in my own teacher's monastery, there was someone who had divined by astrology that he was going to die on the Saturday. And so, like, as soon as he found out, he wandered around the town outside of the monastery telling people all of these profound secrets. Except they all went, what the fuck is that? And that's not Buddhism, is it? And, you know, nobody believed him. but he was like spilling the beans. I spill the beans as much as possible and as far and as like deep as possible, just to see if some of it will catch on.
Yeah. So it seems like this sort of this basic idea that psychedelics are not in any way incompatible or anathema or even ahistorical within Buddhism, and that for the, especially those who might only be at the lower levels of Buddhism or those on the outside coming in and saying, oh, but doesn't Buddhism say you can't do any of this, that's just, it's not true, and that even people on the inside, there are levels of how things get revealed. And, you know, one of the things that I like to say about Buddhism, especially like Vajrayana Buddhism, is that it really starts people more at a dualistic level, right? Where you're making the mandala in front of you, you're doing the beads, you're worshiping the guru figure outside of you, and then you get into the visualization, so you're getting more into the non-dual, and then eventually you're dissolving all of that into emptiness and entering into the Dzogchen realm of, you know, pure emptiness and the pure light of the mind. So as we move through...
Dzogchen is one of the profound paths, which is practiced by the Nyingma school. Mm-hmm. The other three, in modern days three, but it was more like five or six in earlier times, we practice Mahamudra, and it is slightly different. It's like seeing a painting or a statue from two different perspectives. They're both valid, but they're expressed in different ways. But I mentioned both paths, the Dzogchen and Mahamudra paths, in the book. My teacher was initiated into both Dzogchen and Mahamudra, but he concentrated on Mahamudra for his Western students. A childhood friend of his is actually well known in this country. His name was Chodam Trungpa Rinpoche. And I studied with him, first of all, before I met my Lama. I discovered this guy who was teaching Tibetan Buddhism, and he was... it's difficult to describe the effect of Chodram Trungpa. He was like an explosion in the Buddhist society, because he would... I have seen him in the Buddhist Society in London, 58 Eccleston Square, if anyone's wondering. And he would be chatting to middle-aged, wealthy Buddhist ladies who thought themselves very Buddhist.
Yes.
And, you know, they had their prayer beads and they bought all the books, and he would say to them, you know what, you should try LSD. And he would, this was before it was illegal, by the way. I've been a Buddhist a long time. And he would tell these women, you know, it would be a really good idea if you tried LSD. Meanwhile, he was living in a squat in Notting Hill with a bunch of hippies. And he would do LSD with them there. And he would, remonstrate with them that they're not using it properly. Mm. They're not giving it sufficient respect. And he actually told some of the people he was living with, you shouldn't do LSD anymore because you don't know how to use it. And he also told them that in Tibet, they had something called Dutsi Rilbu. Dutsi is the Tibetan for Amrita. Rilbu means pill. And so these were Amrita pills. He said, we've got these things in Tibet, which are stronger than LSD. And I think that just means that he hadn't taken enough LSD, but that's beside the point. Eventually, Trungpa moved to the United States. And before he left, he told my teacher, I'm going to teach Tantra in the United States, but there's one aspect of it I'm not going to teach because I know how Westerners abuse these things. And it was quite obvious that he was talking about Amrita. Mm-hmm. He was talking about the use of psychedelics. Now, there is something odd about Amrita, which I only really fully realized when I was writing Secret Drugs of Buddhism. And that is that the plants which give these psychedelic effects are treated as dakinis. These are enlightened women. And so there was a guy called Kepa Dorje in the 11th century. He was a student of Gampopa, who was a student of Milarepa, who was a student of Marpo, who was the first Tibetan in the lineage. He was a student of the Indian guru Naropa. Anyway, Kepa Dorje came to this place in southeastern Tibet and found that there was a hillside covered with this particular plant. And I've not been able to find out exactly what plant it was because of the difficulties of translation from Tibetan into English. I mean, it's got entries in the Tibetan dictionary, but it gives you two entirely different plants, neither of which is identified by its binomial nomenclature. Anyway, he ate these plants and had a vision of nine dancing dragons. In the sky in front of him were these magnificent dragons, nine of them all writhing and performing this intricate dance. And he was so impressed by this that he founded a school of Buddhism on this called the Dragon Kagyu, the Drukpa Kagyu, which is still going strong in Bhutan, not in Tibet, but in Bhutan. It is it's considered to be a fully fledged school of Buddhism. But it was based on the original impulse to make this school was based on his vision of the nine dancing dragons after he'd eaten this herb. So if we read the Tibetan texts, we will see that there are many, many examples like this throughout Tibetan history. Now, Tibet itself, most of Tibet is very high, very dry, and has practically no plants in it. I mean, you go to a grassy field in Tibet and you see, oh, here's one grass plant, there's another one over there, there's another one over there. It's not a lawn. It's not covered with grass. It's very, very sparse. Similarly for trees, they grow along the Kichu River. Little stunted willow trees grow along the Kichu. You will not find trees anywhere else. And there is only one part of Tibet which is covered with jungle, and that is the extreme southeastern portion called Mön, Munyul in Tibetan. The territory of Mun is what Munyul means. And a modern writer has described his expedition into Mun to find a waterfall, which was described by a 19th century writer. And in his description of this, his journey into this territory, he describes finding a psilocybe cubensis mushroom, or finding several, and he picks them. And he travels on till this, he gets to a caravanserai, a stopping point for travelers. And he meets a Tibetan yogin who says, "You're going to eat those mushrooms?" And he says, "Well, no, not really." And he says, "Do you mind if I have them?" And the guy, like, eats the mushrooms. They see him later and he says, "Those are very good mushrooms. They work great." And so there are also doctors in Tibet, in modern Tibet, who say, "Oh yes, we have plants, mushrooms, and so on, which have profound effects on the psyche, but they won't say what they are." Whereas I have a book on Tibetan medicine, which it describes all the components in, I think it's like almost 100 different medicines. And under the heading of white dutsi, white amrita, it says, "Well, we'd like to tell you what this is, but it's secret, so we'll just go off to the next herb." And so even in modern, like, scientific books on Tibetan medicine, they acknowledge the existence of amrita, but won't tell you what it is. There are two kinds. There's white amrita and red amrita, by the way. They say what's in the red amrita, but they won't tell you what's in the white.
Top secret.
So Trungpa came over to the United States and said, "You know, I've had dealings with these Western Buddhists before, and I know that they can't handle amrita properly, so I'm not going to teach that."
Yeah.
So, but it was quite obvious to me that he was talking about psychedelics.
Yeah. So in the history of Buddhism, as it migrated throughout Asia and went to all these different cultures and different countries, we can see that there are certain elements of psychedelics that have been used and incorporated and often kept top secret. I think here in the West, probably the two biggest forms of Buddhism that have the biggest impact would be like Zen Buddhism and then also Tibetan Buddhism. I think here in Ashland is kind of good representative of that, where we have the Ashland Zen Center, and there are, I don't know how many, but they do have some individuals who are dedicated as monks at the Zen Center, and mostly it's lay people who go and, you know, they do their meditation. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while they do a walking meditation. You can see them walking around the neighborhood in their black robes. And then we also have a Tibetan, I forget which school it's associated with, but there is a Tibetan education center in downtown Ashland, and it's a Tibetan style decorated building. And over the hill from us in the Kolstein Valley, I think it might even be a different school, but there's also a monastery, which is very close by. And so these are, you know, kind of emblematic of how Buddhism has come into the West. I think Zen came a little bit earlier, and then Tibetan Buddhism.
First of all, it was Theravada, what we call Hinayana. Mm-hmm. It was not really Hinayana. Hinayana actually applied to the 18 schools of Buddhism in India before the Mahayana was conceived of. Theravada is not entirely like those 18 schools. It's very much like him, but they've incorporated things like the Bodhisattva ideal from Mahayana. So there was Theravada came first. Then we had people like Daisetsu Taitaro Suzuki, who explained Zen to the West. The weird thing, though, is that he wasn't a Zenist himself. He belonged to a Pure Land school. But he was the only Japanese person we had who would like tell us about Buddhism. So he told us about Mahayana Buddhism. And then after Zen and so on, we had the Chinese invasion of Tibet, which drove thousands of lamas into India, first of all, and then the Western countries. It's only now, though, that certain teachers are admitting that they use psychedelics, like Dzongsa Chense Rinpoche, a wonderful teacher from Bhutan, who is a grandson of Dilgo Chense Rinpoche, who was a magnificent teacher, a Tibetan, of the Nyingma school. And anyway, Dzongsa Chense Rinpoche says that when he was in Brazil, he was visiting Brazilian Buddhists, he did ayahuasca with them. They all did ayahuasca, and they treated it as Amrita. And there is a film of him which is available on YouTube if you want to go and check it out, in which he says that the tantras, the basic texts of Vajrayana, explain that you should take psychedelics, and they explain which psychedelics and so on. And he says, if you don't believe me, I can give you page numbers of the tantras. And then about halfway through the talk, he says, you know what, I took some mescaline before I started this talk, and I'm not feeling it yet. I don't think it can be working. He doesn't realize that mescaline takes 2 hours to come. And so he was a little bit premature with that. He should have waited a little while, and then he'd have got it. Well, I imagine he did get it, but it was after the talk was over. And there's also you reminded me that there is a Buddhist center near where I live in Northern California, and it's called Chabdut Gompa, the monastery of Chabdut Rinpoche. He built this, had this beautiful monastery built, Nyingma lineage, and it's quite extensive. It must be about 50 acres or so, and it's on a little plateau. It overlooks the Trinity River, has mountains in the background. It's beautiful. Anyway, when he built that, he said, well, that's wonderful. I'm off to Brazil now to build another monastery. And everyone went, no, we thought you were going to stay here. And anyway, they didn't persuade him to stay. He left. And he put one of his students in charge, Lama Dorje. The people who had provided the money for this monastery were not best pleased with his behavior. And after he died, they kicked Lama Dorje out. And Lama Dorje left for the San Francisco area. But before he left, he invited all of the residents of the monastery to come and eat all the food he had and drink all the bottles of wine and so on, because he didn't feel like carrying it all down to San Francisco. Anyway, I was told this story by a person who was there at the time, and he says that unfortunately at that time he was an alcoholic. He's not now, but he was then. And after having, you know, a couple of glasses of wine, it just whetted his appetite for more wine. So he went digging around in the kitchen to see if he could find any more alcohol, and eventually found this medicine bottle, an unlabeled medicine bottle. And he took the cork out, sniffed it, and says, "That's alcohol, all right," and knocked it back, the whole bottle. Unfortunately, this was concentrated Amrita. Mm. It just happened to be in an alcoholic vehicle, just something that should dissolve all the substances. And as a result, he tripped for 5 days. Because this was concentrated Amrita, and it was supposed to be enough for hundreds of people. But he had these experiences of Dakinis talking to him and passing on these great nuggets of information. And Lama Dorje had to tell him, just ignore it. You haven't had sufficient empowerments yet. Just ignore what they're telling you. But it just goes to show that certain lamas do have Amrita, real Amrita. And it's possible that if you've had an empowerment, that you may have had a tiny amount of real Amrita in the sacrament that you were administered in this empowerment. On the other hand, that's like one part of modern Buddhism in the West. A few years ago, I was in Australia, and I went to an Australian Buddhist bookshop, which was in Sydney, I believe. Yeah, well, and I said, "How would you like to stock this book, Secret Drugs of Buddhism?" And they went, "Drugs? No, Buddhism is against drugs." And I said, "Well, read this book. It'll put you straight on that." They wouldn't touch it. They would not handle that book at all. Regular bookstores had it, but they were Buddhists and they wouldn't have anything to do with drugs. Well, yeah, that's not quite the way Buddhism worked, though. And they were adamant that Buddhists don't take drugs. And I was there to point out a few of their misconceptions in that regard.
Yes. And, you know, I haven't been to any of the teachings at the local Tibetan temple or anything like that, but I'm kind of imagining that they're probably not talking about Amrita. They're probably not talking about these things.
No. No.
So I think maybe for most Westerners, which is, you know, mostly the audience for your book here, that probably they're coming to Buddhism more from the layperson side, meaning someone who likes to practice meditation, likes Buddhist teachings, maybe has a mindfulness app on their phone, you know, kind of the modern digital Buddhist. And in the book, you point out lots of ways that they can augment their Buddhist practice, however that's being conceived, by the use of psychedelics. So maybe we could talk about some of those practical applications that you have here. Yeah, you even have a section, psychedelic drugs to enhance your Buddhist practice. Again, assuming that we're probably speaking more about lay Buddhist practitioners, not necessarily the monks and the nuns, though hopefully it's at least at some level, these secrets are being revealed to them, and hopefully they get a chance to work for some real Amrita.
One would hope to.
Yeah.
And there was a period from about 500 AD to 700 AD when these psychedelics were involved with Buddhism, but they were in the hands of characters known as the Mahasiddhas, the 84 Mahasiddhas. In this regard, 84 sounds like a very precise number to us, but if you were in medieval India, 84 meant just a lot. You know, just a whole bunch of them. That's it gives these stories, highly symbolic stories of how people came to their realization. And many of them are about psychedelics, even though they're kind of concealed in a language which can be interpreted as being just fanciful stories about magic fairies and so on. But the last story in the book, the 84th story, is not about a Buddhist Mahasiddha. It's about a Hindu by the name of Vyali, who spends all his money trying to figure out what Amrita really is. And eventually the secret of Amrita is revealed by his wife, who, well, in parts of the story she is his wife, in other parts she's a prostitute. And she sprinkles a red flower into, she picks this flower, and it's got red petals, and she sprinkles it into his potion, and suddenly it's psychedelic. Well, I think it's probably more than a sprinkle, and it was not a flower but a mushroom. It was Amanita muscaria. Anyway, having discovered the elixir of immortality, he takes it himself, becomes immortal, gives it to his missus, she becomes immortal, and they disappear over the horizon on the back of his horse, which, just to round out the story, he'd also fed some of this Amrita to, so the horse was immortal too. And they live in this island, this remote island, but somehow Nagarjuna, the great alchemist Nagarjuna, and in the West, with our study of Buddhism as a remote practice, we can see that there were probably three people who shared that name. There was the first century philosopher, and then there was the ninth century alchemist, and possibly one other, Nagarjuna as well. Anyway, the alchemist finds out somehow that Vyali has made a real potent form of Amrita. So alchemist Nagarjuna, happens to have a pair of magic sandals, which are like 7-league boots, that they'll take you at great distances. And so he strides off to the island where Vyali is living, and does a deal with him that for one of the sandals, he'll be given the secret of Amrita. And so that's the last story in the book. But then there's other stories earlier in the book of Nagarjuna making Amrita. Tantric books are not necessarily in the order of the page numbers. One of the things that you're taught as part of an initiation is the actual page order that you're supposed to read the books in. And so there is one where he, there's a story where Nagarjuna takes this student of his called Aryadeva. And Aryadeva goes begging for food, as they, as you know, Buddhist monks are traditionally go around first thing in the morning begging for food, and they eat it at 11 o'clock, and that's the rest of it for the day. That's all they're supposed to have. So Aryadeva comes back with a pancake studded with crystals of sugar held on a pin. And this is obviously supposed to be Amanita muscaria, the red mushroom with like speckles of white on top of it. It looks very much like a confection. And Nagarjuna says, "Where did you get that?" And he says, "Oh, these prostitutes gave it to me." And like prostitutes in Vajrayana Buddhist stories are often, because they're outside of society, they don't see themselves as bound by the restrictions of society. And so Nagarjuna goes off with him to find more of this Amrita. And eventually he does. And he mixes up a dose of the Amrita, drinks it, and then pisses on a bush, a dead bush, which is like devoid of leaves and flowers. And when he does that, the bush springs back into life, sprouts leaves and flowers and what have you. And he says to Aryadeva, his student, can you do that? And he says, well, sure. And he does the same thing with his Amrita and revives another bush. So the story ends with Aryadeva floating off into the sky and performing a prostration upside down. I don't know what that's about, but the rest of it seems to be about the actual components of Amrita. Then we have stories from Tibet of like Longchenpa giving his very first Gana Chakra, and he obviously was a bit over lavish with the Amrita which he used, because there were monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen all at this Gana Chakra which he performed, and when the Amrita took effect, they all started making pronouncements as if they were deities. Like the nuns and the women were speaking as if they were Dakinis and so on. And this is not condemned in any way. It was like, wow, that was a good one, wasn't it? So we find these things scattered throughout. Like Pemalingpa, the famous Terton, discoverer of hidden texts. That's what a Terton is. A hidden text is a terma. And his story begins where he is a young man, a teenager, who is very poor, lives in a falling down shrine. And one day he is off in the forest looking for mushrooms. Oh, he lives in Bhutan, by the way, next to Tibet, not in Tibet itself. And he can't find any mushrooms. And he's very dejected and stomps off home. And on his way, he meets a camper, a man that's not somebody who lives in a tent. Now, a camper is someone who comes from Kham in the east of Tibet. And he says, the camper says, "Why are you looking so glum?" And he says, "Well, I'm hungry and I haven't been able to find any mushrooms." And he says, the camper says, "Well, what's wrong with those right there at your feet?" And looks down and sees these mushrooms and picks them, puts them in his robe, in the fold of the robe called an ambak. And he takes the guy, the camper, back home with him, and he cooks a mushroom and flour curry.
Mike, you were talking about mushroom and flour curry. That's...
Yes, Pema Lingpo. He got all his relatives together and took them to the local river. It calls it a lake in the original Tibetan version of the story, but we know that it's actually a wide portion of every river. And he assembles all his relatives and dives into the water and doesn't come back for almost 2 hours. And they're sure that he's dead because he must have drowned. But he comes back with a casket covered in rhinoceros hide, in which there are texts. One of his relatives says, "Oh, I suppose you're going to have us believe that you're a reincarnation of one of Padmasambhava's students," which all tertons who discovered termas are supposed to be reincarnations of Padmasambhava's students. And he says, "No, I'm not a reincarnation of anyone. After all, who do you think that old Kampa was? That was Padmasambhava." Of course, you see, Padmasambhava had the secrets of Amrita, and he took Amrita, so therefore he is immortal, according to the Tibetan legends. And so the casket, the rhinoceros hide casket, contains these terma manuscripts, and at the end of it says, "And you will find the next terma at such and such a place." And he actually goes from place to place. Each terma he finds says, "And you will find the next one at this other place." And he found so many termas that he's the reckoned to be the fifth of the five terma kings, the great tertons who found the majority of these terma texts. Well, I can't remember why I was telling you that.
Well, Mike,
at least it shows you there is a strong tradition in Tibet of psychedelic use, and it's connected to the terma tradition.
Yeah, well, it's one of the reasons that I really always enjoy speaking with you, Mike, because you're kind of like an unbound multi-volume Buddhist encyclopedia, and you know, I'll pepper you with a question, but we don't know where the page is going to open up and what's going to come out, because there's so much that you have studied in this area. But I'm going to rein you back in a little bit now. I'm going to do some reining back in motions, and let's go back to the question. This has been a great conversation, Mike. Don't get me wrong. I love talking to you, but we still haven't really talked about part one, psychedelics for Buddhists. So we've talked about the history of it. But let's go back to sort of the practical question as the guidebook that your book, Psychedelic Buddhism, is. Again, assuming that most people who identify as maybe Buddhist interested or influenced by Buddhism, you know, like I was one of those. I was one of those people who I studied a lot of Buddhism. I practiced Zen meditation. And actually, kind of like you were mentioning with D.T. Suzuki, that my Zen meditation teacher was actually the head priest at the Pure Land Buddhist Temple in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles. So that was kind of my entry into it as well. But, you know, I never took any vows. You know, I didn't put on any monk's robes. But I considered myself to kind of, at the very least, I would describe myself as philosophically Buddhist. For many years. And so I think that that's kind of where this book is going to appeal to a lot of people is like, yeah, I like to practice Zen meditation, or I like to do maybe some of these tantric meditations, things like that. So how would people at that level, how would they be incorporating psychedelics into augmenting their practice and making it more than just your legs numbing out for 20 minutes?
Yeah, well, it's really difficult to say in general terms how people will use psychedelics in Buddhism. First of all, I would suggest that people try a small amount of a psychedelic, and if it appeals to them, then carry on, take it. It may be that you've just broken up with your girlfriend, or just lost your job, or there might be some other depressing life events which would prevent you from taking a psychedelic. You shouldn't take a psychedelic in those circumstances, and definitely, absolutely not as an escape from your present situation. You should always meet your present situations head on, without any assistance from psychedelics. So if you've met all the requirements of the psychedelic path, then perhaps you could take a psychedelic and see how it would fit your Buddhist practice. Try meditating while on a psychedelic. You might find it a lot more difficult than meditating without the psychedelic to start with, because there are so many distractions, and you've got to be well practiced in disregarding the distractions that you'll get in taking psychedelics. I offer various different ways of using the psychedelics, and one of the more obvious ways is to go off into the countryside somewhere, find somewhere remote from bothersome people, and just do your meditation there. The meditation could be of various kinds. If you're hiking, for instance, you can imagine that you're walking in a clockwise manner around a figure. It could be the Buddha, could be a Bodhisattva, might be a Dakini, but you imagine them off to your right, and you are going clockwise around them. You might actually be walking in a dead straight line. You might be walking in a zigzag through a forest. But in your imagination, you're walking in a circle around this figure. That is a simple way of using a psychedelic in your practice. There are many other ways. I offer some much more complicated visualizations, such as the four Brahma Viharas, and I go into a great deal of detail in how to practice the four Brahma Viharas, which are a vihara is normally a monastery, and Brahma is a Hindu god. And the practice of the four Brahma Viharas was described by the Buddha, but he described it as something that he learned from a non-Buddhist. Of course, he wasn't a Buddhist. He was somebody who the Buddha ran into in the forest. And so the four practices are love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Now, love is simply wanting beings to be happy. And you develop the universal form of all of these four emotions, the four helpful emotions. And so you don't just want your want somebody to be happy. You want all beings, all humans, all animals, all insects, anything which has a motive force to be happy. Now, compassion is wanting them not to suffer. It may seem to be the same thing as wanting them to be happy, but it's actually quite different. It's simply that we are beset by suffering our entire lives, and it's the desire that all humans, all animals, all insects, all fish, or whatever, all aliens, you know, they are, you wish that they could all be free of suffering. Sympathetic joy is basically rejoicing in the happiness of others. I sometimes describe the Brahma Viharas in terms of a parent looking at their child, and if your child is playing happily with other children, then you find happiness in that. And you're a parent, you should know this yourself, that if your young child is giggling and playing happily with other children, you feel a warmth in your heart. Now, the last one is equanimity. And you could put this in the realm of parental attitudes too. And equanimity is feeling the same for all beings, so that you wouldn't feel like more attuned to one of your children and not the others. They are all your children. They are all to be just as happy as each other. Now, those practices can be very, very powerful in improving your own sense of well-being. If you wish all beings to be happy, you're probably in the best possible situation for dealing with other beings, other humans. Yeah, so that's one of the practices in the book. There are a couple of others.
And what would be a good psychedelic that would help augment that practice?
Well, it would probably be best to do it with something like MDMA, which is not strictly a psychedelic, but is perfectly attuned to that practice. I've actually conducted an MDMA, no, it wasn't actually, it was MDA, an MDA session with some of my students, and we did the four Brahma Viharas. It's not very easy to find MDA these days, though. So I would say it's probably easier if you can actually get hold of real MDMA and not any of the scurrilous substitutes which are sold in clubs. And if you can get hold of real MDMA, good for you. And this is a perfect practice to use it on.
So, if we could maybe just make a distinction for the audience, because I think a lot of people are familiar with kind of the quote-unquote shamanic use of psychedelics, where a lot of times there's an emphasis on ritual, there's an emphasis on contacting spirits or entities. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, we have therapeutic use of psychedelics, the idea of overcoming trauma. healing, things like that. Then we have sort of these new psychedelic churches that are looking at psychedelics as sacraments, ways to connect with the divine. If you could just kind of characterize Buddhist psychedelic usage, how would it be different? I'll repeat the question, and then I think maybe, Mike, we're just going to have a part two at some point, because I'll even list you. There's a number of things that I want to ask you about and get your wisdom on from a psychedelic Buddhist perspective. And I'll go through the list. I've just been kind of jotting these down as we've been talking. But Trikayas, entities, deities, reincarnation, tantra, and chakras, and about how I think these things are really often misunderstood or mischaracterized, and I like your approach to all of this that you bring out in the book. And so these are all things I want to talk to you more about, but we don't really have time now. So I'm going to go back to the question then. How is psychedelic Buddhist practice, how is that different in focus and intention and possibly outcomes from what we might call psychedelic shamanism, psychedelic therapy, or even just psychedelic religion in general? How would you characterize that?
Well, that actually comes down to what the difference is between Buddhism and other spiritual practices. And I would say the main difference is that there is no God in Buddhism. And some people, like I mentioned Chogyam Trungpa earlier, he had great difficulty when he began teaching in the United States, when he said there is no God, and people say, ah, how dare you say there's no God? Of course there's a God. And then he was like, I don't know, well, if you don't like atheist Buddhism, how about we call it non-theist? And yeah. I went, oh, yeah, phew. That's a bit better.
Yeah.
And, it means exactly the same thing, but he got away with it. And he was like, all right, we're just doing non-theism, not atheism. But it means the same thing. So that's the essential difference. And that there are certain differences in attitude to your practice. That you see, in Mahayana Buddhism, it's quite accepted that we are all enlightened. We're not striving towards enlightenment. We're just shedding the impediments to enlightenment. We are fundamentally enlightened, all of us. We're all Buddhas. We just have to get rid of the extraneous surroundings which prevent us from manifesting this Buddhahood. And if we can follow the guidelines of Buddhism and behave as Buddhism states, we will be Buddhas. We will be enlightened beings. But unfortunately, it's often hidden from us by neuroses and what are called kleshas and hindrances in English. So things which tie us to wanting happiness for this person, but not for that person. That is that's one of the hindrances to Buddhism, that we should, if we are going to want happiness for one person, we should want it for all beings, whether human or not.
Right.
So that's the essential part, I think.
Yeah. So this idea that within Buddhism, and as you say, particularly Mahayana, this idea that really what the Buddhist practice is to uncover our true nature, to
yes.
go beyond the artifice of who it is we think we are and how we partition the world into I like this, don't like that, want that for this person, don't want that for this other person, but shedding these dualistic layers to reach further into the non-dual nature of being, where everything is unconditioned, where there are no absolutes, where it is the formlessness of the Dharmakaya. And realizing that we've always been that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, we can't put the Dharmakaya into words.
No.
It's beyond words, beyond concepts. And we can appreciate it, but we can't, like, tell it. And even if we could tell it, it would bore the socks off people. They would not really want to hear that. That's not what people want to hear. But it is what we want to be, really, where we want to dwell in the Dharmakaya. And unfortunately, it makes it very difficult to talk to anyone, because you could have then enter the world of concepts and forms and so on, whereas the Dharmakaya is beyond all that. But if we want to express ourselves and express the profundity of the Dharmakaya, we've got to step outside the Dharmakaya to do that. We've got to do it from a point of view of the Sambhogakaya or the Nimanakaya. The Sambhogakaya is best expressed as a flow of information or energy, and the Nimanakaya is how things appear. So I see this laptop, I see the table, but I don't label it as a laptop, I label it as a table. So these are these kayas, these bodies. It means body in Sanskrit, and so it's the way in which a Buddha is thought to exist is in these Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, and Svabhavikakaya. They are expressed as being different things, but they're basically all like one tarball, if you like. You can't take one bit out and leave the others.
Yeah, and Buddhism itself is that engagement of skillful means, the communication of through relative concepts, relative truth, to hopefully point us back to the absolute truth, the true nature of being, which, of course, we can't really say anything about, because as soon as we're using words, we're back in relative truth, we're back in conceptuality, we're back into this, not that, yes, not no, or, you know, however we're going to parcel it out. And, you know, I'm in general agreement that I think that psychedelics can be very fruitful in the application to Buddhist practice and Buddhist teaching. And I think that it is quite different from what we think of as psychedelic shamanism. And I think it's different from psychedelic therapy. And also the idea of, well, I'm going to go to church, I'm going to take a sacrament, and then I'm going to connect with the divine or connect with the angels or whatever it may be that, you know, the focus of Buddhism. And this is where, you know, I don't identify as a Buddhist, but certainly my sympathies, my affection lends far more towards the Buddhist approach than really any other approach that I've encountered as someone who has a PhD in religious studies. That for me, it's like Buddhism is definitely closer to my heart. So that's a very personal statement. But it's because it feels a lot more valid. That for me, that really is the quest of how do we uncover our true nature and encounter that, and then hopefully live from that place.
Right. I mean, my Buddhist career started when I, as a high school student, I went to a talk in another school. There were various talks all week, and I went to the one on Buddhism only because I was allocated it. I didn't want to go to that one. I didn't want anything to do with religion at all. And I argued with everything that the guy said. I brought forth objections to everything. And eventually, when he finished, I went up to him and said, "That was great. Where do I learn more about this?" And he was completely banjaked, Steve. He was baffled. He said, "I thought you were against it all. You argued with everything I said." And I said, "I know, but you gave the right answers. And I want to find out more." So apparently I learned later that is actually what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
That is how you're supposed to behave towards Buddhism when you first encounter it. Ask a lot of difficult questions and see what their answers are.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I enjoy about Buddhism is that, you know, this is the way I used to teach it in my religious studies course at SOU, Intro Religions to the World. I said, you know, what one of the things that's unique about Buddhism is that when we go to most of these other traditions, their ultimate answer is, well, that's what God told us, or that's what God revealed. But if you go to a Buddhist, they actually can give you a rational conversation around any point that is raised within Buddhism, because none of it is just, oh, this is what was handed to us, so this is what we believe.
Right. Even such things as reincarnation.
Yeah.
There are, in the West now, there are people who question reincarnation, question why Buddhism should have such a belief in it. And if you actually delve into the sutras, you find that it's only mentioned once. And that's when the Buddha is getting ready for bed. And his attendant, his cousin, Ananda, says, what do you think about this reincarnation stuff? And the Buddha says, well, what do you think about it? And Ananda says, you know, well, I think it's probably true. And the Buddha says, well, there you go then, and goes to bed. He actually doesn't dwell on it at all. I tend to adopt the same kind of attitude to all dogmatic beliefs and forms of religion. It's like, well, maybe so, maybe not.
Yeah, and it does come back to the question of how does that help you here and now if you want
right.
to obsess over these questions? Yeah.
Quite, exactly.
Yeah. Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure. It always is. And in the here and now, I do have to go run and get Jaden, but I wish you the best on your trip to London. And I'd certainly look back fondly of memories of wandering around London with you at Breaking Convention quite a few years ago and sipping your cannabis tincture, your homemade
yes.
cannabis tincture. So well, I hope you have a great time, and let's continue the conversation somewhere down the road, because there's a lot more things I'd like to talk to you about. And
I would love to, yes, because you brought up some very interesting questions that you have written down for further investigation, and I would be delighted to discuss those with you.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to it, Mike. Thank you so much for your time today, and sorry we had internet transmission troubles.
Oh, well, no problem. And say hello to Jaden for me.
All right, I will do that. Excellent.